This is a BICOM podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM, based in Jerusalem. It's Thursday, the 28th of May, and I'm delighted to be joined by my former colleague, Neri Zilver. Neri, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
My pleasure, Richard.
Neri, as well as being formerly with BICOM, is a prominent journalist reporting from Tel Aviv, where he lives. And perhaps most importantly for today, he is also the author of a very important study, which I recommend listeners find online, produced by the Washington Institute, called A State with No Army, An Army with No State, The Evolution of the Palestinian Authority Security Forces. And obviously with kind of in the context of Abu Mazen's announcement last week, I'd love to explore this issue with you. So Neri, if we can start off, what did you make of the announcement? I mean, we've heard these kind of threats before, but it seemed on this occasion that he went actually to implement some of it soon afterwards. So what was your initial thoughts on that?
That's right. So last week, a lot of people may have dismissed Abu Mazen and the Palestinian leadership's decision to sever ties with Israel, and primarily on the issue of security coordination between the Palestinian security forces and the IDF and the Shin Bet and the various Israeli security forces. But truth be told, I wasn't surprised. I think the important thing, as people look on and discuss what's transpiring here on the ground, is the political and strategic context within which Abu Mazen and the Palestinians are taking these decisions, right? So I think the big thing coming down the pike, perhaps as early as July, is annexation. The new Israeli government's intention to annex at least parts of the West Bank. So with that being said, and the Palestinians looking at that as a major red line for various diplomatic and political reasons, they had to push back. They had to push back against both the Netanyahu government, the Trump administration, which is reportedly tacitly supporting such a move in the West Bank, as well as sending a message to the wider Arab region, Europe, and the international community that everyone needs to at least work together on behalf of the Palestinians to stop it. And if you look at the tools at Abu Mazen's disposal, I would argue the only one with real weight on the ground is a security issue. And I think that's the context within which he took the decision. And then we can probably get into what it actually means. But I think it's important for people to realize this is unlike past crises and past statements and threats made by Ramallah, precisely because the strategic and political context has changed and will perhaps change in a few weeks.
What would the ramifications be on the ground, you assess?
So I think, first of all, it's important to take a step back and understand what's exactly meant by the term security coordination between the PA and Israel. It's this kind of catch-all term that gets thrown out there a lot. It's name-checked. But really, it's both kind of an operational doctrine, if you will, various operational facets and components that go into it, as well as a larger and wider strategic concept. So, you know, operationally, it's everything from counterterrorism against Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the West Bank, which the PA and Israel do together and jointly and quite effectively. It's things like deconfliction. So the IDF gives the PA a heads up whenever it feels the need to go into Area A of the West Bank, Palestinian cities and villages for arrest operations. It's riot control, keeping Palestinians away from various friction points in the West Bank, and onwards and upwards. And so these various components of security coordination are now in jeopardy. And that's the operational part of it. The wider kind of strategic concept is really the question of whether Abu Mazen feels the need and is willing to go ahead with a certain level of escalation on the ground vis-a-vis Israel. Palestinian officials that I've spoken to, as well as just looking at their public statements, I think even they have said that there's a certain red line beyond which they're not willing to go. So I think, you know, stopping major terrorist attacks will continue. They'll still, you know, stop that from happening. If an Israeli civilian wanders into a Palestinian city or village, I don't think the PA security forces will just sit idly by and let that person perhaps be harmed. I think they'll still continue, as they have done for many years here, kind of safely retrieve the Israeli and return him back to the IDF. So I think there are certain red lines, but really overall, and taken together, the threat of both miscalculation and escalation does increase, after Abu Mazen took these steps, which they've begun slowly to implement.
Do you buy the argument that it's kind of in both sides' interest to keep up the security coordination, essentially because of the shared threat of Hamas poses to kind of to establish its own infrastructure and terror cells in the West Bank?
I think that's undoubtedly true. It's a major Palestinian interest. It's a major Israeli interest as well, sometimes underrated in the public discourse here. And it's a big reason why the West Bank has been relatively stable. I use that term on purpose, relatively stable for over a decade. It's almost night and day different in terms of the security situation on the ground in the West Bank over this time period than it was definitely during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, and definitely during these kind of glory days of Oslo, when buses were being blown up and terrorist attacks were quite common. So we haven't seen a lot of that really over the past decade. I think that's a testament to the importance of security coordination and the fact that it is both an Israeli and Palestinian interest. But again, it brings us back to the political context, right? So Abu Mazen really, really doesn't want to do this. There's a reason why he's been in power for 15 years, and he's never really and seriously and consistently gone down this path. There were moments where coordination or various aspects of coordination were suspended, but that was temporary and partial. So I think now Abbas might feel that he doesn't have many good options, and so he's threatening and perhaps moving forward with the step, which he knows runs a real risk for him and the PA in the West Bank. I'd argue that the real threat isn't so much from Hamas, although they'll undoubtedly try to utilize any kind of vacuum or escalation. But I think the wider concern for Ramallah is just a breakdown of law and order and chaos if they kind of unleash certain forces on the ground. I think that's the real concern on their end.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned before kind of he did this because he doesn't really have any other tools, any other options at his disposal. And just to link that to something else you just mentioned, the kind of questioning the temporary nature of this decision. I mean, Israel controls still obviously all the entrance and exits to the West Bank. It still controls the money that flows into the Palestinian Authority. How long is this sustainable of stopping this the security cooperation before it kind of necessitates itself to reopen the channels?
So I think a distinction needs to be made between pure quote-unquote security coordination and the wider economic, medical, social ties between Israel and the PA. I don't think those, primarily the economic ties, can and will be severed. I think there's almost too strong of a Gordian knot between the PA and Israel economically to actually do that. But suspending certain aspects of security coordination are, in theory, more feasible and are, in theory, more practical in terms of a pushback option by the PA against Israel. So I think coordination will continue. And I'd almost argue the opposite, that people last week were looking at this as almost an on and off button, that, you know, Abu Mazen pressed off on security coordination, whereas I think a better way to look at it is kind of a calibration or a gradation of what he's actually suspending and what he's actually continuing. And in that sense, I think this is only the beginning. In other words, this is kind of the opening shot, or as they say in baseball, in American baseball, a brushback pitch against Netanyahu and the Trump administration and various other international actors. But I think if the Palestinians perceive annexation as actually moving forward in a real way, I think they'll increase the measures they take, and arguably suspend or sever additional ties in the security realm.
I mean, let me ask you a more basic question. Do you think this is real? There are lots of Israeli commentators suggesting this is part of Israel bluff, that essentially, once the security establishment in Israel kind of really gets a chance, perhaps now under the leadership of Gantz as opposed to Bennett, to air its true opinions to the Israeli political establishment, that a lot of cold water is going to be poured on this, or has Netanyahu kind of committed too much to back down now?
So normally I'd have agreed with that thesis. You know, it's almost a bridge too far in terms of the risks Israel runs for annexation, which I think on the ground de facto won't quite change all that much. So normally, you know, you're already seeing it. You're already seeing prominent security figures in Israel, whether former or even current, through the media here, coming out against the idea of annexation and warning of the real threat of violence and instability on the West Bank, which is in nobody's interest. Having said all that, I think the political context in Israel is a bit different, and you see it with how Netanyahu has handled this issue. So annexation first came about last year at the height of the various election campaigns that were fought here, and everyone almost dismissed it as a campaign ploy to grab right-wing voters. Nothing out of the ordinary with that. However, after the recent campaign, the recent election in early March, Netanyahu, once he was negotiating with Benny Gantz and the Blue and White Party, insisted on including annexation in the coalition agreement. And not only that, it was the only issue in the written agreement, in black and white, that Netanyahu was allowed to move forward with, without really taking into account Benny Gantz's veto power, which he has over, I think, every other issue in this unity government. So Netanyahu included this in the coalition agreement, allowed himself the option of bringing it to a Knesset vote regardless of Gantz's position, and also set a firm timeline for when he could do it, which is after July 1st. So all of that.
But just to add, the coalition agreement also states that it needs to be done in complete coordination with the international community and respecting previous treaties and regional stability. How does that square to unilateralism?
So that those issues in terms of maintaining or ensuring Israel's strategic interests and regional peace, that's in there, but it's not a actionable clause. The only other actionable clause, as it's written in the coalition agreement, is the consent and approval of the Trump administration. So at no point does the coalition agreement say that either Gantz has a veto or these other various interests supersede Netanyahu's ability to bring the annexation issue to a Knesset vote, regardless of what comes out of the cabinet, even. So, you can argue that they provided themselves some wiggle room to press the conversation and to press the issue. But in terms of what they legally agreed to, Benny Gantz and Blue and White don't have veto power on this particular issue.
And how committed do you think the U.S. is? I mean, obviously, the U.S. are dealing with a range of other domestic issues as well as other international challenges. How invested do you think is the Trump administration in this process at the moment?
That's a great question. The short answer is I don't know. My sense is that Netanyahu wouldn't have gone out so far ahead of this issue if he wasn't at least somewhat certain that he had the backing of the Trump administration, or at least various factions within the Trump administration. It beggars belief almost that that he would go out on this limb. And also he's repeated his annexation promises and intent over the past week or two in public speeches and in interviews that he's given. So we don't have any real sense that Netanyahu himself is backing down. So I can't imagine that he's priming for a full-on collision with the Trump administration. I don't think that's in his interest. In terms of the Trump administration's own thinking, I think they're waiting to see what the reaction is from various Arab states and other international actors, which you're getting some of. You're getting some pushback in terms of the annexation issue, where it falls and whether Trump will actually give Israel and Netanyahu a green light to move forward, that's still an open question.
Just on the Arab states, there seems to be a contradiction, at least in some parts of the Israeli media are assessing this contradiction, that there are public statements which are, as you can imagine, appropriately condemning, or from their perspective, condemning any move on annexation, whilst they're also kind of quoting unnamed senior Arab officials that say that kind of when it comes down to it, they have other national interests that supersede the Palestinians' concerns, especially with regard to their relationship to Israel, and that they basically, on a genuine diplomatic level, they don't intend to cause such a fuss. Do you think that's credible?
I'm a bit more skeptical. I've seen those reports. Oftentimes, it's coming from various kind of right-wing Israeli media outlets and outlets known to be supportive of Netanyahu. I'm skeptical, but I think it speaks to a wider issue, which is how Netanyahu and certain parts of the Israeli government view the current strategic context within which they may move forward with annexation. So the Arab states obviously have, in recent years, solidified their relationship with Israel, primarily in terms of military and intelligence and certain economic ties. That's shifting and has improved greatly, especially in the various campaigns waging all over the region against Iran. So that's a common interest that the Arab states and Israel share. And farther afield, you see, you know, Israel looks at Europe. It sees it very much preoccupied with the corona pandemic and internal disagreements over issues unrelated to Israel-Palestine. It looks at America with the Trump administration in power, obviously highly supportive, but also heading into a re-election bid in November. So from Trump's perspective, it might be useful to curry favor with pro-Israel supporters and evangelical voters in America ahead of the election. So the strategic concept in terms of Israel's thinking might never be better in terms of actually pushing this through. And to speak to your initial point, there might be pushback and anger internationally, but will they actually translate that into concrete steps to punish Israel for this step? And I think Israel isn't sure that that's a given, and I'm not even quite sure that the Arab states in Europe and the UN and various other actors are quite certain what their response will be if and when annexation happens.
I mean, we still don't know. We're still waiting for this US-Israel mapping committee to kind of produce their results and to understand kind of the depth and extent of this move. Do you think they're going to go kind of full hog and go for the Jordan Valley and all the Jewish settlements, or go for something more symbolic and incremental at first?
So I think the real answer is we don't know. I'm not quite sure they're sure about how far they want to take the annexation if and when they move forward with it. My gut instinct is that they'll do something a bit more conservative than a full-scale annexation of all the settlements in the West Bank and the entire Jordan Valley. I think it'll be a bit more circumscribed and conservative as an opening gambit, I would argue, for Israel's intentions vis-a-vis the West Bank. That's just a guess, but I think Israel might bank on the fact that if they only annex parts of the West Bank, say the settlement blocks near the Green Line, which hold most of the settler population, that'll be a bit more in the consensus both in Israel and perhaps in various parts of the world, that it won't draw as sharp a reaction because they can come back and say, hey, this, you know, in any peace agreement, we're going to be keeping this land. We just might be preempting it a little bit. I would say that in conversations I've had with Palestinian officials, they don't view it as any different. In other words, they don't view, annexing the settlement blocks as okay versus, you know, the entire, all of the settlements in the Jordan Valley. They view it as an issue of principle and of precedent.
Mm. The other issue kind of hovering in the background to all this is the political context of Netanyahu's trial. We heard kind of quite an unbelievable speech that he made on the steps of the courthouse on the first day of the trial, where he really trying to obfuscate the idea of it being a criminal investigation and frame it as the left and kind of the Israeli deep states, if you will, kind of against his right wing agenda. There are some conspiracy theories out there kind of that suggest the result of that he's laying it up for failure, that he's then able to blame the left, the media, the legal establishment when he backs down on annexation as a point in his trial to prove that he's no longer able to govern because of those influences. Do you buy that scenario?
I don't, you know, I'll buy a slightly different scenario or conspiracy theory or however you want to call it, which is that Netanyahu, as you mentioned, he got on the courthouse steps right before his the opening of his trial, and he said this is a conspiracy to take down a right-wing prime minister. I think he said this explicitly, if I were to withdraw from the West Bank and give up settlements, then I'd be fine, that there would be no legal issues, there would be no conviction, indictments. That this is a plot by the left-wing media and deep state to topple me precisely because of my intention to annex parts of the West Bank and to ensure the future of the settlements. So I think he's setting it up as that dichotomy in order to solidify the right-wing support that he has and may well have throughout the course of this trial. But I think the more interesting issue is whether Netanyahu, after issuing all these promises and ensuring that, as I mentioned, the annexation would be included in the coalition agreement, and he's doubling down and repeating his intent to annex, whether politically he can even back down and climb down from this tree. It's an open question to my mind, absent perhaps a red line from Donald Trump. But if that doesn't materialize, I think it'll be very difficult for Netanyahu to not move forward with annexation.
Neri, thank you very much. We'll leave it there. But for our listeners, kind of watch this space, both for Neri's own writing on the subject and further BICOM output as we will continue to explore this subject ahead of the July the 1st deadline and I'm sure afterwards as well. Thank you very much, and Chag Shavuot Sameach for all our listeners as well.
My pleasure, Richard.
Thanks very much. Take care.